Hey, it's great to be with you. Welcome back to Charting the Course. We are here today with another Squared Away conversation as we just wrapped up the second quarter of 2024. So as we're going to reference, and we'll get into a little bit more here in a little bit, we're recording this during the second week of July. So we've got some more data to come out. We've got a handful of kind of current events that we're going to hit on. So it has been an eventful start to the third quarter. But all in all, we've got a solid labor market. We've got consumers continuing to spend, so just a resilient consumer, and inflation is cooling. So you've got some confidence coming in to investors, and so they've continued to buy stocks. But as always, I'm joined by Zach Reynolds and Austin Burks. We've had to pivot a little bit. We had complication in the podcast room, so I'm joined by Austin here at the office, as well as Sam Warner, our newest investment analyst. So Sam, we're thrilled to have you on board. And Zach's coming to us all the way from the beautiful, cool temperatures of the Rocky Mountains. So, well, Zach, Austin, we appreciate it. Zach, thank you for calling in. We can kind of work from anywhere, so we're going to remote in a podcast today. So thank you both for being with us.
We had a flood in the podcast room, and I'm coming in from our Rocky Mountain outpost here this week. So yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah. So nobody out there tell us that we don't try to get you information out. We do our best. I'm also joined here in studio by Sam Warner. I don't have him mic'd up today because I don't want to scare him off, but he's joining Austin and I, and Sam, we're thrilled to have you part of the team. So I just want to give you a little shout out, but let's jump right in here, guys. Like we always do, to say a lot has happened is an understatement. So we are coming off a weekend that had a past president was attempted to be assassinated. And then the market's done what the market always does, which is completely, you know, just outsmart people. So what thoughts do you guys have though, as we look back over this last week and a half of this third quarter, based on kind of, Zach, what you wrote in our market update, just some high level thoughts here before we dive in.
Yeah. I mean, it was a pretty incredible second quarter, continuing on a strong first quarter. S&P through the end of June up more than 15% when you include dividends, 31 all-time highs. Again, through the end of the second quarter, we've made some additional all-time highs since then. But you know, one of the things that I wrote about, and I'm certainly not the only one seeing these things in the market, and we'll talk about the Wall Street Journal and Jason Zweig, some of the things that he said recently on the same topic, but the market is increasingly concentrated in the largest companies. And that honestly is creating some issues for active managers who pick stocks, for passive investors like us who like to use sector exchange traded funds. But from a numbers perspective, Microsoft, Apple, and Nvidia are now more than 20% of the total index. And in particular, Nvidia has performed so well this year that it's been responsible for a huge amount of the total gain in the market. That's good in a lot of ways. And for folks like us who try to own near market weight for each stock, we've certainly benefited from Nvidia's gain. But it's created an interesting dichotomy in the market where these largest stocks have a massive impact on market performance. And then, you know, one way to look at it is the bottom 493 stocks. So outside those top seven that make up more than 30% plus of the market, just haven't done that well. So, you know, if you are a stock picker and you're not owning those largest stocks, or you're not owning them at full market weight, it's been almost impossible to match the market performance
right
of the S&P 500 this year.
Austin, any commentary there?
No, I mean, all of what Zach has said is absolutely correct. And it's been very interesting to watch the concentration kind of play out.
Yeah.
You did finally start to see a little bit of broadening towards the end of last week with some of the Fed data that came in, and kind of expectations shifting towards the Fed cutting rates maybe a little bit sooner. It would be great if the rally kind of broadened out a bit more. But yes, to Zach's point, so far this year, it's mainly been driven by the narrative of the increasing concentration, not only within the technology sector, but the S&P 500. But then there's also other sectors as well that have seen increased concentration. So it's been really interesting to watch so far.
Oh, for sure. As you guys, one thing we've really hit on, I feel like, on the past 8 Squared Away episodes is, what's the Fed going to do? What are they watching? It appears to be we're down to possibly pricing in really just 1 or 2 cuts before January. I think one cut in September is like a 90 plus percent probability.
94, yeah.
And so
You got it.
Are you guys kind of seeing the same stuff there as far as, you know, they keep pricing it in? It's almost this point now, if they don't cut rates, I think the market might be a little surprised. Is that fair?
Yeah, I don't think there's any question. In fact, I looked this morning, Austin, I know you and I look at the same Bloomberg function to look at the market's probability of a cut. It was at, I think you said 94% this morning. I've actually just pulled it up to 100% right now. So markets are currently pricing in the certainty of a cut during the September 18th meeting, and then about an 86% probability that we get another cut in December. So yes, two cuts, to your point, Tyler, is the most likely outcome. And Austin referenced this, but what really changed the market's viewpoint was the CPI number for June that we got last week that showed inflation continues to cool. You're seeing Fed members come out and express a lot of confidence that while not defeated, inflation is heading certainly in the right direction, and they feel confident enough to move from a very restrictive stance to a somewhat less restrictive stance, which, you know, we would expect to see markets continue to price in those cuts over time. When you think about the impact of those interest rate cuts on the stock market, it makes sense that stocks, particularly stocks like in the small cap space, which tend to have higher debt levels and shorter term debt, they're going to benefit more from those decreases in interest rates. And as Austin referenced, it was very encouraging to us to see last week small caps strongly outperform large cap stocks. That's something we've been looking for. We've talked about it on this podcast, and it's certainly great to see a few days where you had small caps outperform by several percentage points, or so hundreds of basis points of outperformance in a single day is a pretty dramatic turn versus large cap stocks.
I want to hit on a couple of things, specifically some things you hit on in the market update that went out to our clients. One of those is just the, and we've already kind of hit on it, but I want to dive in a little bit more on just the concentrated market and as much detail as you guys want to go into, Zach and Austin. People are aware of how we invest. We use ETFs or index funds to get access to the broad capital markets. And what we don't do, though, is we're not sitting here, you know, overweighting or underweighting in any individual position. So we have the ability to avoid concentration risk because we are not going to put all of our eggs in one basket, so to speak. But let's spend a little bit of time of why the market has been so concentrated. And to your point, Zach, how you're now starting to see some of the other areas of the market outperform just those, whatever it is, those top 10 stocks, if you will.
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing you said, and Austin, chime in, because you might have, you did a lot of research for us on this point, but yes, as the biggest individual companies have become larger and larger weights within the S&P 500, it has caused some issues, even for folks like us. So for example, we use the largest technology tracking ETF in the world, XLK. However, the SEC 80 years ago put in place concentration limits within regulated investment funds like XLK that say you can't have massive weights to individual stocks, otherwise you're going to violate diversification requirements. So because the market has become so concentrated today, and NVIDIA and Microsoft and Apple are such large components within that ETF, even that ETF that seeks to track technology sector returns is limited in how much it can have, how much weight it can give to each of those stocks. So even within that technology ETF, you're not quite getting the full weight of stocks like NVIDIA for the first half of this year. They actually did a rebalance now, where they increased NVIDIA, but they had to lower their Apple exposure so that the combined weights of the largest three companies did not exceed, 50%, I think, that they can't exceed?
48, yeah. But essentially, they don't want the largest three names to be more than half of the fund is essentially right. the concept to try to limit. And when the rules were put in place, the goal was to limit how much concentration there would be that a fund could get in. Right. So if someone was uninformed, they didn't get in something that was just in a couple names. Now, it's obviously had all of these knock-on effects 80 years later that weren't anticipated at the time.
Yeah, it's crazy to have an 80-year-old rule still having an effect today, but here we are.
That's absolutely right. And yeah, I mentioned Jason Zweig of the Wall Street Journal writing about this recently, a couple weekends ago, July 5th, this came out, but the headline was why your fund manager can't beat today's stock market. And he makes some good points about active managers. And we've talked about this on this podcast many times in the past. Most active managers underperform the market because they charge higher fees. Well, this year, in addition to the fact that active managers tend to charge higher fees, they also, much like we are with our fund XLK, active managers have restrictions on how much exposure they can have to any one stock. So Zweig talks about, this is a pretty damning number, but in the first half of 2024, Morningstar reports that only 18.2% of actively managed mutual funds and exchange-traded funds that compare themselves to the S&P 500 managed to outperform it. So just in a six-month time period, you know, 82% underperformance is pretty dramatic. And again, part of that is attributable to fees. A larger part this year is attributable to position size limits within those funds.
Mm-hmm.
So his kind of comment at the bottom of that article, which again we'll link to, was that portfolio managers can talk all day about how it's becoming a stock picker's market. And you know, people say that. Stock pickers tend to say that every year. And we tend to laugh at them because it never actually seems to work out that way. But he goes on to say, unless they pick exactly the right stock, and unless they pick massive quantities of exactly those stocks, they aren't going to outperform the market. And that's just certainly been true. Now, all that said, I want to go back to something I talked about in the market update, which is the equal weight index, how it's performed historically. So equal weight being you give each company in your particular universe the same weight. So S&P 500, every stock will get a 0.2% weight versus a cap weighted or capitalization weighted index. That's what, if you go buy the S&P 500 ETF today, you're going to get a cap weighted index that has the largest exposure to the largest companies. That makes a lot of sense in a lot of ways, but an equal weight index will say, nope, NVIDIA, Microsoft, Apple, you get the exact same weight as the smallest three companies in the S&P 500. So it has an effect of dampening the impact of the largest market components, overrepresents the smaller companies within the index. So in that way, it kind of leans toward smaller cap companies in whatever universe you're going to look at. What's interesting about that is a lot of people are comparing today's market to the late 1990s when you saw technology companies really get outperformed massively, become very large relative to other companies. I think there are some important differences in today's market where the largest companies today have a ton of revenue and they're highly profitable, whereas in the late 90s, that was not necessarily the case. So I don't buy that, you know, history is going to exactly repeat itself here. I think Apple, for example, is going to continue making money for a long period of time. I would be very hesitant to say that Apple's a bubble stock, for example.
Sure.
NVIDIA is certainly more expensive, but still, it's, you know, you could have said that last year and NVIDIA is up over 100% over that time period. But what was interesting to me, JP Morgan did some research. They found that since 1990, the S&P 500 equal weight has actually outperformed the market cap weighted version of the S&P about 52% of the time if you look at rolling monthly year over year periods. And then if you look at valuations, so for the average stock in the S&P 500 from an equal weight perspective, trades at about 16.3 times. Versus 20.5 times for a market cap weighted valuation measurement. So all that says to us is we don't know when, but historically speaking, there's likely to be some reversion to the mean where you see the average stock in the S&P 500 outperform the market cap weighted index. Again, kind of interesting timing from when our market update came out a couple of weeks ago to today, because over that 2 week period, we've absolutely seen that phenomenon where the smaller stocks, the average stocks have outperformed the larger stocks.
No, it's been fascinating. I wish I could give you credit for writing that and then knowing that was going to happen, but I can't. So sorry.
Well, I've been saying it for a while, but we highlighted it at a good time right before it happened. Now, we've seen little false starts, and I'm always quick to you know, say this to our advisors and our clients. You know, it's really hard to know, except with the benefit of a substantial amount of hindsight, whether this will be when the worm turns, as I like to say. But it was, like I said, very encouraging when the day the CPI number came out to see small caps outperform large caps by about 400 basis points. So that's really substantial outperformance. There's a long way to go. Small caps are still way underperforming the cap-weighted S&P 500 this year. But I would sure love to see those stocks catch up by having great performance versus the largest stocks in the S&P 500 fall, right, to come back to the average stock.
No, I appreciate that. I think that's a great explanation. One other thing I wanted to hit on, and honestly, I think, and we've talked about this, I think this is probably going to have to just be almost a whole podcast series to really dive into it, but that's the whole world of alternatives, or kind of a better explanation is just the private market, the private markets out there. Access you can only get through working with an advisor, working with a firm, or having just a lot of money. So one thing we've worked on, and one thing, Austin, I think you and the team have done a really good job of putting together some investor profiles, and we continue to refine those. But I thought here, let's spend a little bit of time looking at what are our target markets in the space? What do we continue to look at in that private investment world? And then kind of real briefly highlight the investor profiles we've put together and what those are. Because I think it's just fascinating to see the world in which we operate and kind of what we look at.
Well, I think just first at a start, part of the reason why we want to target and look at alternative investments in the first place is we are trying to find asset classes that we can add to the portfolio where we can create exposure and give clients exposure to less correlated asset classes. And this goes back to modern portfolio theory. But within alternatives, there is a massive dispersion, a difference between not only similar funds, but also just completely different types of asset classes. So within alternatives as a broad bucket, we've kind of narrowed it down in the interim or currently to three different asset classes within alternatives.
Okay.
Clients that have been with us will recognize these names: private credit, private real estate, as well as private equity. So these are kind of the three main buckets that we've kind of narrowed it down to. And so within those asset classes, we're trying to focus on long time horizons, trying to create broad asset class exposure to these asset classes that should give us uncorrelated returns. The issue with it, though, is unlike in the public markets with the S&P 500 or the ACWI IMI, there's not a true index that you can just go out and buy. There's not a fund or an ETF that just gives you access or exposure to the asset class in the same way, namely because these are private markets. There's a lot less visibility into everything that's out there, even though there's a massive universe of that is investable out there. And so what that calls for is not only is deep due diligence as it relates to each of these asset classes, but it also creates the need for personalization. And so that's kind of where these investor profiles came from. And the reason why there's a need for personalization, and I know I'm kind of rambling on, but
no, you're good.
As it relates to who is allowed to invest in each of these funds,
right,
there is a limit based on income or classification. And those get pretty technical in the weeds, but I would encourage you to talk with your advisor about where you kind of fall within these buckets. But so essentially we've created these buckets that based on what your situation is, it should allow you to have a more personalized profile that would have specific weights to different types of investments.
And real quick, high level, we kind of view it as once a client has $1 million in investable assets, which is our client minimum, which is why we have a client minimum, because then we feel like we can actually provide some actual good advice and some access to some of these products. But really, once until you get to $1 million, then we believe we can start carving out a piece. And that's kind of that first bucket, if you will.
Right.
Somebody may have $1 million in investable assets, regardless of income. We got to have the assets there to allocate to, correct?
Correct.
I mean,
I mean, just to add on, guys, to what Austin was saying. Yeah. And Tyler, $1 million gets you kind of in that accredited investor space. Historically, even if you had $1 million, yes, you had some access potentially to alternative investments, but it wasn't very democratized.
Right.
What has been interesting and good in a lot of ways, although there's some risk that gets created here too, is that there's a lot more access today. There's a lot more products out there. There were some really bad products out there historically. Certainly when I started my career in the 2000s, you saw a lot of non-traded REITs, which were very high fee, and most of them did not perform very well. That's why Austin referenced it. Due diligence is incredibly important in this space.
Mm-hmm.
And then moving out from accredited investor up to what's called qualified purchaser, which is $5 million+, generally speaking, that's going to unlock a different set of opportunities within the private investment space. And then, you know, for us, we also have a number of institutional level clients who may have much longer or perpetual time horizons versus our individual private wealth clients. And so for us, we looked at it, and trying to fit everybody into one bucket just didn't make sense. So we continue to evolve our approach to alternative investments as the market itself evolves. We've talked about some of the main reasons why we think alternative investments make a lot of sense. I think it's worth reiterating here. You're seeing companies stay private much longer, and the returns or the wealth created by those companies going much more to private investors versus public market investors. That's particularly true in private real estate or private equity, excuse me. And then private credit, again, an asset class that really didn't exist in its current form until about 15 years ago, post global financial crisis. It has exploded in the last few years, and it's been a great place for us to invest so far, and it's been a source of some really strong return. And then private real estate, when you look at the publicly traded real estate market, you only get access to a very small sliver of the actual investable private real estate universe, and you tend to be overexposed to some markets or to some segments of the private real estate market that you may not want to be overexposed to. So, for example, malls. You know, malls are struggling. And if you're just a private real or a public market REIT investor, you're going to have a lot of mall exposure.
Oh, yeah.
So for us, being in the private real estate world and being able to invest more fully into things like data centers, which are growing dramatically and have very high demand relative to mall demand going forward, we think it's a really good opportunity and something that we feel really obligated as fiduciaries to look at very closely and make sure our clients have appropriate exposure to.
Just to kind of put some numbers to it, when you look at, and as Zach was saying, to as fiduciaries, our job is to not only take a look at everything out there, but determine if it's suitable, if it's investable, but to put some numbers to what is out there in the private markets. You've seen since 2000 to 2023, let's call it, you've seen the private markets go from 1 trillion to 10 trillion. And that's also growing at a faster rate than the public side of the market is. And so there's so much more opportunity that's out there within the private markets. But at the same time, just because there's opportunity doesn't mean it's good opportunity. And so we want to be very thoughtful and careful with how we make our determinations and make our recommendations. To kind of put a wrapper on it, as Zach was saying, it's more about not just having a one size fit all type of portfolio within alternatives. It's about kind of creating that personalized recommendation for each level of investor that's out there.
Oh, and I think the important thing for our listeners, our clients, our potential clients to understand is that we're never going to sit here and say we need to own 100% private investments if you have $5 million. We are still completely bought into the fact that, you know, the capital markets are efficient, and we're just talking about a percentage of your overall allocation that's going to allocate to something that's uncorrelated. And I think that is something we'll continue to dive into, but I wanted to hit on it a little bit here because it's continuing to become more of a conversation, which is exactly to Austin's point, because now you've got this massive market out there with a lot of money staying in that private side. So guys, I want to spend a little bit of time here as we wrap up this last 5 minutes talking just about the next two quarters as we end the year. I mentioned it at the beginning, but we're coming off a weekend that was absolutely insane as far as politics go. And this is not a political podcast, and we're not here to take sides. We just look at it from a capital market standpoint, pro-capitalism standpoint, saying what do we see, what do we think's not maybe going to happen, but what are we anticipating? And so I wanted to give you guys some space to kind of talk about it just from the investment side of things, because if you've been listening to us or reading our material for any length of time, you understand that we've pretty much flat out said the market really doesn't care who's in office. You're trying to time in and out of the market based on the president, based on Congress, is just a fool's errand pretty much all the time. So I wanted to give a little bit of space there because we will get questions, and I'd rather address it than have people make an assumption based on what maybe they think.
Yeah, Tyler, I love the way you teed that up. I mean, I mentioned it, I think it was even the last quarterly update, the spring update, looking at some of the historical numbers around different presidents from different parties.
Right.
And I agree. I mean, stocks tend to go up regardless of who's in the White House. That's because capitalism works, not because the president is, you know, I heard Biden the other day claim that he created 200,000 jobs. Okay, presidents don't create jobs, right? The economy creates jobs.
Right.
And whether it's Democratic or Republican president, we have a capitalist system, which is generally going to be good for folks like us who own equity. So I agree with you on that. Now, certainly, I would never claim that the policies presidents enact don't have an impact on the market. And that's where it's been interesting to watch the market reaction relative to what happened last weekend. So okay. I always look at actual betting markets when it comes to looking at who is most likely to win. And already this morning, you're seeing websites like Predict It, where people actually wager real dollars on political outcomes. Trump's chances of becoming president have increased pretty dramatically, above 60% now. And you're also seeing a knock-on effect where markets, which always look ahead, so markets are not looking backward, they're looking ahead at trying to price in what the best view of the wisdom of the markets is in terms of what will happen in the future. Now that Trump looks more likely, though not certain, and I do want to point out, I remember back in the 2016 election when it was Hillary Clinton versus Trump, you know, betting markets had Hillary, I think, is about a 60-65% favorite. Obviously, she lost. So it is not a certainty that Trump will be president. But I do think it is the base case at this point, and the market is starting to price in the base case effects. And some of the things that Trump is in favor of, things like low taxes, markets, stocks certainly like low taxes. He is, on the other hand, though, he has proposed a 10% across-the-board tariff. Markets historically have not liked tariffs, and that's probably a negative for international companies. It's potentially going to be, he's most likely a president that, my guess is, higher or as high deficits as we've been running. That is probably an argument if you, taking the historical view of interest rates, that interest rates are likely to be higher because we have higher debt. So that could have an impact, maybe not so necessarily good for bonds under that environment. And then the other thing you're seeing is an expectation that the dollar will increase in value. So again, that's going to have some potential impact on markets. You're already seeing that happen just based on the events of last weekend. So really interesting. Again, I totally agree with you. Anyone, and I've heard it over my career several times, you know, clients will say, well, if President X gets elected, I'm going to get out of the market, or you know, if President Y gets elected, I want to go all the stocks. We would certainly not recommend investing under that sort of a framework. But markets are certainly pricing in what they expect to happen in November already.
Yeah.
The only thing I'd add is you're seeing it, like another data point, you're seeing it in the 30-year treasury yields. You're kind of seeing it in Bitcoin because Trump has been very pro cryptocurrency recently.
Yep.
You've seen solar energy start to, those shares have slumped today. You have seen somewhat of an initial reaction in kind of your typically red or typically blue kind of industries. But beyond that, to Zach's point, like the market is starting to price in, at least in terms of interest rates and those sorts of things, like what the base case scenario would be. But I completely agree with what Zach's saying in terms of not making a overall portfolio allocation decision based on who is president, just because that is not something that is going to be able to be predicted like 2016 shows.
Yep.
And I think if we are doing our jobs, if any wealth manager advisor is doing their job correctly, then we're focused on goals, and goals don't change based on who's the president, based on what the economy is doing. So I think the best thing we can tell people is it already is noisy. It's always noisy. It's about to get really noisy. And this is when that investor behavior, having a quote unquote coach or having somebody there to kind of talk through that with you, in the form of an advisor or wealth management team, I think is so important. You got to have a sounding board, because we deal with the same things that any investor deals with as far as things we worry about day to day. And so, again, our approach is always going to be long-term. Markets are efficient, but we've got to make sure we're allocated in the right way, and we're focused on goals and not necessarily some rate of return or, you know, some dollar amount, I guess. But that's kind of my lasting thoughts. Zach, do you have anything as we wrap up here?
Yeah, I mean, Tyler, I totally agree with what you said. And one thing that I've reminded some folks of recently within the firm is, you know, if you think about who's going to get elected in November, they're going to be president for 4 years. Again, let's assume it's Trump. probably it will be his second presidency. So he'll be term limited out, plus he'll be, 82, 83 by the time he finishes his term.
Right.
When we think about allocating dollars in client portfolios towards stocks, I tell people, look, you need to have really a 5-year plus time horizon on those stocks. So it really doesn't matter who's president. We're looking well beyond the next term of the president when we're investing in the stock market. So again, just to reiterate, we don't want to make moves in stocks based on what's going to happen in this next election, because you really have to have a much longer time horizon.
Oh, no doubt. I agree. Austin, anything as we wrap up here?
That's it for me.
Guys, I appreciate it. Thank you both. Zach, thank you for carving out some time for us. Get back out there to that Rocky Mountain air.
My pleasure. I'll do it.
We don't hate you. We just dislike you right now. All right. Well, hey, thank you everybody for listening. As always, we sure appreciate it. If we can ever do anything for you, your family, your friends, your colleagues, do not hesitate to let us know. We're here to help. And the more we can continue to hopefully help educate and equip investors, then we're doing our job right. So we'll be back with another Squared Away at the end of the third quarter. And if it's noisy now, it's going to be a blaring rock concert at the end of that, just because we'll be, the start of the fourth quarter at that point. So, all right, y'all, we'll be back again soon. Thank you guys for the time, and everybody have a great rest of the day.
Thanks.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed today's conversation, don't forget to review and subscribe through your preferred podcast platform. Have a great week. All opinions expressed by the host and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Full Sail Capital. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. Clients of Full Sail may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.